Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks, offering cool climate wines that capture the essence of Oregon since 2002. In this episode, we feature Irish writer Colm McCann. To me, McCann is the definition of fearless. Seemingly without a second thought, as a young man fresh out of school in the 1980s, he bicycled across America and then later moved into the abandoned subway tunnels of New York City to live with the homeless in order to research his first book, This Side of Brightness. Later, he joined construction workers on half-built skyscrapers, overcoming a paralyzing fear of heights to truly understand the work of these men. In this talk, he links together This Side of Brightness with his National Book Award-winning Let the Great World Spin, his novel Transatlantic, and tantalizingly, a forthcoming book. The title of his talk is Can't Go On, Must Go On, Storytelling and the Refusal of Cynicism. The phrase can't go on, must go on is, of course, from Samuel Beckett, one of Ireland's greatest 20th century writers. And really what McCann is asking is, in the face of so many challenges in our world, what is the purpose of storytelling? His answer is, I think, empowering to us all and offers us a way to reframe the world in which we can change it through the stories we choose to tell about ourselves, our communities, and the stories we truly listen to, even absorb, something that McCann refers to as radical empathy. I'll let him explain what that means. Here's McCann.
I'm terrified. Wow. I'm kind of glad the lights are bright so I can't see. Thank you so much for being here. I'm going to talk tonight. The title of my talk is Can't Go On, Must Go On. Obviously a line from Beckett, but it's Can't Go On, Must Go On, Storytelling and the Refusal of Cynicism. So there you go. So I feel like I'm home in a way. I'm very fond of Portland for a lot of reasons, not least because my brother Ronan and his wife Anne live here, and they've been here for 22 years. They're real Portlandia people, is that what I say? It's like, Ronan, where are you? He's somewhere around here. There he is. He's the handsome one in the family. He's got more hair. I also have so many people here that I like and admire, but you know, guess what? I got to spend some of this afternoon with the great Barry Lopez, who's here tonight too. Barry's here with his wife, Deborah. What a lot of fun that was. And it just seems to me that there's something happening in the city. There's also difficulties. You walk around and you see what's going on and the... It's shocking in some respects and invigorating too to see how a city is evolving and moving. But I very much feel at home. I came through here 31 years ago on a bicycle. And I had started my bicycle journey in Boston in 1986. And went across the United States. And I told the young people this morning, the kids from Madison, about some of my stories along the way. It was great fun to sort of revisit that. But I remember the generosity and the spectacular openness of being along Highway 1 and Highway 101 and various towns here in Oregon. So it's nice to be very much back. So can't go on, must go on. This is what Borges said to Roberto Bolaño in a conversation that they had together. He said, "A writer, and I believe generally all persons, must think that whatever happens to him or her is a resource. All things have been given to us for a purpose, and an artist must feel this more intensely. All that happens to us, including our humiliations, our misfortunes, our embarrassments, all is given to us as raw material, as clay, so that we may shape our art." And I'm not sure that if I want to privilege the artist here, but I love the idea that all things are given to us for a purpose. And perhaps that purpose is to make us see. And that all things that are given to us are raw material that we may shape our lives. So I'm going to tell you stories about four books that I've written and how they are connected and how they are linked and how they lead to examining this notion of stories and storytelling and how eventually one hopes that they lead to the refusal of cynicism. So, in the 1990s, I had published my first collection of stories, Fish in the Slow Black River, another novel called Song Dogs, and I was living in Japan with my wife Alison, and I came to live in New York. And I was at a party for Grand Street Magazine, which was one of those wonderful literary magazines that you had in New York at the time. And the editor there was a young lady by the name of Deborah Treisman, who is now the fiction editor of The New Yorker. And I was going, and there at a party had a story of mine come out, and I was chatting to this African-American gentleman, and we were just chatting away about life in New York, and he was going, you know, telling me stories, and then eventually halfway through the conversation he said, "And all the homeless people who live in the subway tunnels." I was like, "Oh, what do you mean?" He says, "Oh, yeah, here in New York, we have like up to 5,000 people living homeless in the subway tunnels." And I was completely stunned. Now, I didn't really know New York at the time, but I thought, that's a story. There's definitely a story there. So I went down to Riverside Park and 79th Street, or 72nd Street, the very next day. And sure enough, I could see a lot of people moving in and out of this tunnel that ran between 72nd Street and all the way to 125th Street. At the front of the tunnel were a lot of people who were actually sort of, we would classify as refugees, but apparently deeper and deeper and deeper in the tunnel were people who lived in various forms of darkness. And, you know, their lives were tough. And I went and I stood at a gate by 98th Street, big iron gate that led down to the tunnel. And it's the only time in my life, and I don't do this anymore, thanks be to God, but it was the only time in my life that smoking was ever any good for me. Because I stood outside the tunnel and I waited for these homeless people to come out outside the tunnel. And immediately, if I saw someone come out, I'd light up a cigarette and they'd come over to me and ask me for one. And then they'd stand in front of me, and it's almost Promethean, you know, you give someone the cigarette and then you give them fire. And you get a moment where you can look them exactly in the eye and you make a decision about them. And if, you know, if you're going to be able to talk to them and, you know, if they invite you to go into the tunnel, will you go in with them? Will you not go in with them? And I did this on and off for about a week until I met a guy by the name of Marco, who became the model of a character that I later wrote about in this novel called This Side of Brightness. The character's name is Tree Frog. And I also met another guy by the name of Bernard Isaacs, who was a model for another character who was in the tunnel as well. It was an extraordinary period for me, on and off, for about a year and a half. I stayed down in the tunnel, not every night, but like sometimes for 2 weeks at a time. In fact, I have to tell you that, you know, I didn't try to look homeless in any way. You know, I just dressed ordinary but coming back on the subway after being a week or 2 weeks in the tunnels, I'd sit down on the seats, and people would go, and suddenly everyone would begin to move away from me. Like, my wife Alison used to have me take off my clothes in the corridor, and we were in this like a series of apartments, and all the other people living on the same floor would say, "Who's that mad Irishman taking off his clothes in the middle of the floor?" But I got to know that world, and I looked around the world, and really what I was trying to write was a book about, which is really essentially the history of a homeless man, the alternative history of a homeless man. But walking through the tunnels one day, I was trying to search out my story and figure out what it happened to be, and I looked up on the a plaque at the entrance of the tunnel, and it said 1917. And I thought, oh, of course. Once upon a time, these tunnels were actually built by people. They weren't always here. And then I went to the library and I began to investigate, what it was like to be a sandhog back in the early days in New York. Turned out that the tunnels were built by the Irish. They were also built by the African Americans. It was the first integrated union in the United States. And the story got bigger and bigger and bigger for me as I went along. In the end, I ended up spending about 4 years working on this novel. And part of what happens to my character, Tree Frog, is that he becomes an iron worker. He works on the skyscrapers high in New York. And I I love writing books, partly because I get to write what I don't supposedly know. I get to investigate the world. I get to be involved and see new things and go to new places. With Tree Frog, it meant that I had to go up on the skyscrapers in Lower Manhattan. Now listen, I'm terrified of heights. It's bad enough me standing near the edge of the stage right now. I went up and I had to walk on these narrow beams high in the air with guys who came from County Mayo and then also Mohawk Indians who were teaching me what they did high in the air, working with the headache ball, working with putting all sorts of structures into place high in the air. It was an extraordinary couple of days when I was up in the air. And I thought, well, this will help me. And, I'll be able to write my book, but I'll never really ever use it again. And I thought, well, that's fair enough. I've had the experience. The experience is enough. And isn't life just an accumulation of various experiences? And in the course of doing that, I, of course, read about, building skyscrapers and so on. And I read a little book by Paul Auster, who mentioned another person who'd been on the skyscrapers, Philippe Petit, who had walked on the World Trade Center towers in August 1974. I thought, well, that's cool. Beautiful thing. And I forgot about it, completely forgot about it. It's just one of those glancing moments that sort of arrive in your life and then they're gone again. And I went ahead and the next novel I wrote was a little book about, or the next book I wrote was called Everything in This Country Must, about Northern Ireland. Then I did a novel called Dancer, which is a fictionalization of the life of Rudolf Nureyev. You shouldn't have Irish men writing about dancing. You can't dance. But finally, a few books later, well, it's not really true. That's the way I should tell the story. I'll tell the story a different way. On the morning of 9/11, I was sitting in my room, my writing office. At that stage, I was living in 71st Street and 1st Avenue in New York. And I heard the sirens go off outside the window. Now, 71st Street and 1st Avenue, for those of you that know New York, is an area with a lot of hospitals. And there's always lots of sirens going off. So there was nothing really unusual that was going on. So I was sitting there working away and hearing all this commotion going outside the window. And thought, fair enough. And then I got up from my chair and went out to get myself a cup of coffee. And the phone light was blinking. And my wife, Alison, said, I think your sister Siobhan called from London. She sounded a little bit hysterical, but I couldn't hear the actual message because she was doing things with our daughter Isabella, and she was getting my son Johnny Michael dressed. And I said, oh, okay, that's fair enough, you know. But I walked past the machine and I pressed the little flashing red button, and sure enough, Siobhan was saying, are you okay? Is everything all right? Is everyone all right? Please call me, please call me. What is she talking about? Is everyone all right? And over my wife's shoulder, I sort of thought, I should figure out what's going on. I pressed the remote control on the television, and there, literally over her shoulder, because her back was to the screen, was her father's building where he worked, and it was on fire. He was in the first building to be hit, the second building to come down. He got out, thankfully, unlike so many who didn't. And he walked up through town, but he had walked out into that glaucoma storm of debris. You know, all that dust coming down. There was dust in his hair, and he'd been hit by some falling material, and he'd sloshed through the water in the basement of the building, coming down the stairs. And he would never forget the faces of the young firefighters and the police people going up past him as he came down the stairs. Anyway, he walked up to our apartment, and he. My daughter, 4-year-old at that stage, Isabella, ran down the corridor, same corridor where I used to have to take my clothes off, jumped up into his arms, and then she recoiled. She hid. And we found her in a cupboard after a few minutes. I said, love, what's wrong? Come on, come on. She says, well, Poppy's burning. And I said, no, no, love, there was a fire downtown. She was too young to understand any of this. There's fire downtown. And then she said, no, 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 you don't understand. It's just the smoke on his clothes. And she said, no, 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 you don't understand. Poppy's burning from the inside out. And I remember I had the same reaction as you, as many of you just had. The oxygen was gone from the air. And I knew she hadn't said it purposefully or consciously. She wasn't making some sort of poetic statement, but it was an intuitive statement. And I think that what she was talking was about a time that was burning from the inside out. And I remember thinking, wow, I'm going to have to write about this. And I remember almost immediately, after going down to the Red Cross and trying to donate blood and wandering around, but almost immediately that evening remembering, oh my God, don't you remember that essay from years and years and years ago when Paul Auster talked about Philippe Petit walking across the World Trade Center towers? Isn't that amazing that those towers are down now? And that my memory and my imagination can somehow access an image that still has a man sort of triumphantly high in the air between these two towers, a quarter of a mile in the sky. And I remember registering it and thinking, if I ever do write about this, which I kind of knew I had to, that I would use the image of Philippe Petit walking across the World Trade Center towers, and it goes back and forth 9 times in August 1974, and thinking, how strange is it that everywhere that I have been seems to crop up in everywhere that I am now? And I thought it was quite a beautiful thing. And a gorgeous way to properly engage with the world. And so I wrote the book, Let the Great World Spin. And some of you might know the book. I was very lucky to get the National Book Award for it. But really, the book is a symphony of the city. It's a collection of people's lives and how they come together and how they collide and how they glance off one another and how they achieve this rarity of grace and forgiveness even in the face of all available evidence. Like, the world is tough. The world presents itself in a very dark a dark manner, and there are lots of bad things happen to people in that book. But in the end, there is always some way for us to emerge, and that was my philosophy about how we should live our lives. That we have to engage with the darkness. But only by engaging the darkness do we recognize that there is actually some form of light that is apparent. In doing that book, I studied the art of the tightrope. And of course, well, I hired a guy one time to teach me how to do a tightrope. He got me 1 foot off the ground. That was enough. But I did. I learned how to do the tightrope. I read about Philippe Petit and the buffalo hide shoes, the balance, the showboating. You know, how to kneel on the tightrope, how to wrap your foot underneath, what the balancing bar was all about, how it helped you, and all these things. And I thought, wow, I'm lucky. I'm a lucky person. I get to learn all these things, write all these things, sort of experience them, go to the University of Life again, and write about it, and figuring, well, you know what, I'll never use that again. But it was great. It was great fun, and I loved writing about it. From the opening salvo, which is Petit going across the wire, to inventing things about him, practicing in a meadow in Colorado and jumping into snow and doing all these things. It was wonderful for the imagination to engage with the act and the art of the tightrope walk in order to eventually talk about what I wanted to talk about, which was that available beauty. So, fast forward again to the next book, which is a book called Transatlantic. And I won't go too much into Transatlantic, but one of the characters in Transatlantic is that it's a really rare thing to say, that wonderful politician. Yeah, everybody's laughing. I mean, it's really funny right now, isn't it? That incredible man, Senator George Mitchell. And Senator George Mitchell, who as you know, was the senator from Maine, who helped us in Ireland negotiate our peace process after 700 years of rancor and bitterness and a 35-year recent warfare since the late 1960s. Senator Mitchell came in and somehow got us together and got even achieved the peace process, peace without reconciliation, all the parties that eventually signed the Good Friday Agreement were never in the same room together at one time until they signed the agreement. But he did this incredible thing, and I got to study it, and I got to write about it, and I got to think about it, how this beautiful man, this man of grace and style and dignity and empathy, had helped us to achieve something that seemed absolutely impossible. So I wrote about him in a book called Transatlantic, thinking, well, that's it. I'm done with Mitchell, right? And I'm done with Petit, and I'm done with all of this other stuff. But it was great. It was great at the time. But again, always in the back of my mind, there is this knowledge that everywhere we have been is everywhere we are now, and everything we have experienced is something that helps us move into the present moment. Now, in the course of this, of writing both Let the Great World Spin and Transatlantic, in fact, in the course of all books that I write, I had points where I thought, I just can't go on anymore. Honestly, when I'm finished a book, I'm so exhausted by the material and by myself, frankly, that I don't think I can do it again, that the world is narrow for me once more, that the weight of reality is too much to bear. I walk around the house, I throw the work away, I wake up, I feel paralyzed. There are times, you know, I consider myself to be a pretty open person, a pretty happy person, a person who likes to live his life out loud. But I promise you, there are times, especially when I finish the book, when I think, I just don't want to get up out of bed anymore, you know? I fear everything that's around me. I fear that I've given my kids too much. I fear that the work is useless, less than useless. It gets dark. The dark dogs of the mind are out there. I wonder why I left Ireland in the first place. I wonder why I didn't become a hedge fund manager. Think about things like, why am I writing about something like climate change or the things that really matter? And I hop from this to that. My mind is a maelstrom, an absolute maelstrom, a carnage shop. But in the end, I kind of have to figure that I must go on, that somehow these things that I'm learning and somehow these things that I've finished are eventually going to be connected, that there is a tissue here. Right? That there is a meaning, and whatever of chance and whatever of connection, there is a purpose for doing all of these things. And do I know what that purpose is? No, not really. But I hate to disappoint you, but as David Foster Wallace once said, that the writing life is so much more about spirit and character than it is about intellect. And sometimes we just have to operate on the fumes of the mysterious. But then I realize that what I have to do is just go on. And so here is Samuel, a quote from Samuel Beckett from The Unnameable. You must go on. I can't go on. You must go on. I'll go on. You must say words as long as there are any, until they find me, until they say me. Strange pain, strange sin. You must go on. Perhaps it's done already. Perhaps they have said me already. Perhaps they have carried me to the threshold of my story before the door that opens on my story. That would surprise me if it opens. It will be I. It will be the silence where I am. I don't know. I'll never know. In the end, in the silence, you don't know. You must go on. I can't go on. I'll go on. And everything, when I think about that passage in that book, everything that I've ever done leads me to the present moment. And so I got to tell you that I haven't talked about this before, but I'm going to tell you about the present moment where I am. Because of Mitchell, after Ireland, Obama asked him to go to the Middle East. And he went there for a year and a half, almost 2 years, to try and negotiate some sort of process in the Middle East. For a lot of reasons that we won't go into right now, it didn't work out for him. He was shafted by various parties, both American, Israeli, Palestinian, and he never got the chance that he really should have gotten. But also he felt that there was no sort of available peace there. And I thought, and he said, it's an incredible place. I was talking to him, he became a friend after writing Transatlantic, and I said to him, but you know, can you explain to me what goes on? And he said, no. It's like a never-ending shape, and I was fascinated by this. And I think writers write towards their obsessions. You write to figure out what it is that you know or what it is that you want to know. So I'm in the midst of, actually, I'm only really in the beginning of all of this right now, so I probably won't emerge for another 2 years or so. But I'm writing a novel called A Paragon. Actually, I bet there's one or two people in the audience who might know what that word is. It's A-P-E-I-R-O-G-O-N. Anybody know what that is? Any mathematicians out there? Do I hear a yes? No? I've still only met one person who knows exactly what it is. It was one of Obama's speechwriters, in fact. And a paragon is a shape with a countably infinite number of sides, which is kind of really beautiful when you think about it, right? A shape with a countably infinite number of sides. In other words, it will go on forever, but you can actually count it as it goes, and you can see it increasing as it goes. That seems to me the perfect way to describe Israel and Palestine and the situation that's going on over there. But guess what? Here's where it all comes together. I'm researching all of this stuff, and who pops up but in May 1987, Philippe Petit. He did a walk in 1987 across the Hinnom Valley between the Jewish and the Arab sections of Jerusalem. He thought of his walk as an olive branch. He called it walking the harp because the valley, which is the valley of hell, really, was shaped like a harp, and he was stringing his 300-meter wire across from the Jewish quarter to the Arab quarter. But guess what? The day before he was to do his walk, Petit decided he was going to do something really spectacular, and he was going to release a dove halfway across the wire, right? Beautiful, really, you know, sentimental, but beautiful. And so he went down to the streets of the old city, and any of you who've been to Jerusalem know what it's like, those little alleyways and the souks and the people here, and then there's the Armenian quarter, the Christian quarter, the Jewish area, the Arab area. It's a fantastic maelstrom of people and history, and Jesus walked here, and you got the Via della Rosa, you got everything, and it's all there. It's in this throbbing heart. The original story is all there. So he decides to go down to buy himself a dove, right? And yeah, you can find anything in those streets. You can find peregrine falcons, you can find parrots, you can do all sorts of things. But guess what? Irony of ironies, he can't find a dove in Jerusalem. Market to market, among the street stalls, the herbs, the fruits, the vegetables, the clothes, the souvenirs, the crosses, the shops selling mezuzahs. He talked to vendors, hotel concierges, went to butcher shops, upscale delicatessens, looking for anyone who might know where he could buy a white dove. Nothing. Parrots, partridges, yes, but no doves. And that's a part of him sort of relished that acute irony, you know. But he still continued the search that day. But the next morning, on the morning of his walk, he was waved down by an elderly man with a scraggly beard and a dark robe who said to him, you know, come with me. And he said, I have your bird. And he was great. Oh, fantastic. You have my dove. And so they go to this shop, and there's all sorts of colorful bolts of cloth around it. And there's a row of birds in the cages, but they're pigeons, not doves, right? A dove is a form of pigeon, but a pigeon is a much bigger bird and not quite as white. So Petit thought about it a moment, and he said, ah, frigate, anyway, like, you know what? I'll take the pigeon. And and so he took the whitest pigeon he could find, brought it back to his hotel room, and practiced releasing it from... this sounds rude. Practice releasing it from his trousers. He had pockets in his trousers, right? And he had the trousers. One half was Palestinian colors, and the other half was Israeli colors. And he would practice, and he wrapped the pigeon in a red handkerchief and put it in. And the bird would flap around the room and landed on the bed. And so that evening, he thought, well, you know, it's not flying around the room too much or anything, but that's okay, you know. It's all going to be fine. So he puts the pigeon, wraps it real tight in the silk handkerchief, steps out from the Spanish Colony Hotel, just Spanish Colony building, just yards from the Mount Zion Hotel, in this court jester uniform, and walks out halfway, 150 meters above the valley of where, you know, so much biblical history had taken place. 40,000 people were there to watch him. It was an official walk. And it was kind of beautiful because they were clapping from the Arab side, clapping from the Jewish side. And he was going across this place, which has all these stories of sort of a hellish sorrow. And it looked perfectly choreographed. He got to the middle of the wire, stopped a moment, paused above the valley, and with skill, he adjusted the balancing bar and reached into his right-hand pocket. As it was the Israeli pocket, right? You can make of that what you will. And he felt for the bird. And, you know, he felt a small heartbeat rapidly against his fingers, and he slipped the bundle out and shook the bird free. He's like, go now, go. And he's thinking, this is fantastic. Guess what? It landed on top of his head. And he's thinking, ah, Jesus, I can't walk across the rest of the valley of hell with a bird of peace sitting on top of my head. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? So he knelt down on the wire in the same way that I remember him kneeling down on the wire when he walked across the World Trade Center and he did that act of creation. And he knocked the bird off the top of his head, thinking, okay, it'll flap off. Now here's this mad flapping, and he thinks, okay, fine. And then he hears the crowd roar again. He looks out at the end of his balancing bar. The bird has landed on the end of his balancing bar. Oh, my God. And he's like, what am I going to do? I can't walk across the valley because the bird gets up and does all these things. I'm going to fall, you know? And so he gets down again and he knocks the bar with the back of his hand. So, and then the bird takes off and he thinks, Jesus, you know what? The bird couldn't fly. And that's it, you know? But he hears a flapping behind him and, like, you know, maybe in the market they clipped its wings or maybe it was upside down or whatever it was in my pocket, but it just couldn't fly. And then he's walking along and he hears this mad clapping and cheering from the crowd. And he looks behind him, and the bird of peace is walking back the same way that he came. And I thought, wow, what a metaphor, what a metaphor. At the end of it all, he gets to the end of the wire. The bird apparently went back near his hotel room. He claims it climbed into the window of his hotel room. But he got airlifted off the wire by a helicopter, and he actually flew out over the valley and into Beit Jala and places like that, which were around Jerusalem. And he became the one to fly. Petit makes these spectacular gestures to humanity, to the idea of stories and storytelling. He always has done. And I think that what he does is he sort of enables us to exercise our imagination in the most extraordinary way. And I don't know where it's going to take me my next series of books, but maybe I'll be writing about a pigeon or a bird of peace at some particular stage. I hate to tell you that 7 months after Philippe Petit's walk, the very first Intifada began. So that's, there are good things here. There are bad things here. My job as a storyteller is to try and find the good that goes on in these things. Now, so you can see the progression of these stories and this storytelling that's very important to me. Now, there is a certain moment of cynicism in that when I say to you, that 7 months later the First Intifada began. But what I want to really speak to you tonight is about the refusal of cynicism, because and I had a chance to talk a little bit about this on the radio today, but cynics, I believe, have it easy. Cynics have their world neatly folded and prepared. Cynics, in my experience, are not very agile at all. Some of them are smart, but it strikes me that they're never quite smart enough, that they're cursed by their own rigidity, that they're limited by the notion that human nature itself is limited and that goodness cannot occur. And I think optimists, who are often accused of being sentimental, are much smarter and more fluid than the cynics, especially if they can embrace the cynic and sit with the cynic and tell her or him that, yes, they are exactly right. I love meeting cynics and telling them, yeah, you're right. It's right. The world is a shit box. Yeah. Yeah, it's all terrible. Yes, the Intifada began 7 months later. Yes, all these things happened. And then saying, so what? So what? No great revelation that we live in this darkness. No great revelation that things aren't so good right now. No great revelation that human nature is flawed. No great revelation in all of this cynicism that they cart to the dark corners of the parties that they, they make miserable, in fact. I believe that the most wonderful way to make cynics unhappy, and nothing is funnier than unhappiness, said Samuel Beckett. The only way to make cynics unhappy is to call them the sentimental ones. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Because the cynics come to me, McCann, you're just a sentimental. You just say human nature is good. And then I tell them that no, they live in this very limited, narrow, tiny little world that they refuse to go out of, this small territory. They're not explorers of any kind. They're not journeying in any way. They are the ones who are cursed by their own limited rigidity. And a true optimist, a really muscular optimist, all of you people who believe that these kids that I met this morning, that these programs that we run in literature, that these stories that we tell to one another are important, are vital, a true optimist is able to be a cynic first. Absolutely be a cynic first. Why not be a cynic? Yes, it is dark, but so what? You have to vault away from that somehow and be bigger than the cynicism and be more muscular than the cynicism. Stories are not them airy-fairy things. The fact that there are teachers out there talking to kids about hope and forgiveness and decency and things that are right, that's not airy-fairy. That's not wrong, you know? It seems to me that the ones who are doing truly, truly good work are prepared to wear their heart on their sleeve and risk themselves being a smart. Thank you. They have to have the courage of their own potential failure. A good optimist will be able to go toe-to-toe with a cynic. And in fact, the good optimist might be able to beat the cynic at his or her own cynicism. This relates to everything, but in particular, it relates to the politics of today. Lincoln said that in order to destroy your enemy, you must become his friend. We are living in a time where we are all at great odds with one another, and the proper refusal of cynicism will be the ability to somehow embrace what it means to be someone else. This comes down to stories and storytelling. All very idealistic, of course, so what? But I would rather be that man wearing his heart on his sleeve than the smart sitting in the corner of the room. Does this mean that writing and literature can change things? Yeah, I think so. Writing and literature can change things. Stories and storytelling can change things. But I want to tell you that what this leads me to is an organization that I'm involved in that's very much going in tandem with what people are doing in literary arts. It's an organization called Narrative 4, where I believe that stories and storytelling and the exchange of stories with one another can help us to shape and change the world in an extraordinary way. We started this organization a number of years ago, and I will tell you that one story from Narrative 4 is that, you know, this the gun debate that's going on right now and how fractious and difficult it happens to be. Well, we got people together in Manhattan last December, this recent December, 2 months ago. We got gun activists, gun enthusiasts, we got gang members from the south side of Chicago, we got African-American female police officers from Baltimore, we got people who'd been gone through Sandy Hook, people who'd gone through the trolley shootings in Utah together, to come together, people from vastly different ends of the spectrum, a sort of small democracy of America, to come together to talk about guns and gun violence. And what we wanted them to do, thank you, what we wanted them to do was to step into one another's shoes. So one of those people was Carolyn Tuft, a mother from Utah, who had not only lost her daughter in front of her eyes, but had also been filled full of bullets, so much buckshot in her body that she now has lead poisoning in the mall shootings of Utah in 2007. Incredible woman. We paired her up with a guy called Todd Underwood, who's the owner of United Gun Group. And United Gun Group is an online gun selling site that sold the rifle that killed Trayvon Martin, for a Kel-Tel PF9 or whatever it happens to be, for $250,000. This gun was worth $250. He was he's a man who, you know, who believes in the Second Amendment, all this sort of stuff. Anyway, these two people from diametrically different things, you know, for, against, and we got them together, not just to tell their own story, but to tell one another's stories. This is the trick. This is the empathetic trick to the refusal of cynicism, I believe. So Todd had to get up after listening to Carolyn's story, and he had to say, "Hi, my name is Carolyn, and my daughter was killed." And then Carolyn had to get up and say, "Hi, my name is Todd. I own 150 guns, and this is why I believe in having guns in the world." The tension in the room, I got to tell you, was absolutely electric. But they managed to make a quantum emotional leap into one another's worlds. Have a look at New York Magazine. They have it online. These two people, for a moment, they became each other. They understood differently. They saw with different eyes. Something magical occurred in the difficulty of trying to understand someone completely different from themselves. It was not so much a chemical reaction as a chimerical one. It was extraordinary. Carolyn said afterwards that having stepped in this man's shoes, the world had been shifted for her. Her mind hadn't changed about gun ownership at all, no. But she understood the complexities of the debate in a far deeper way. A further nuance had crept into her heart. She could feel herself embracing contradiction. The essence of intelligence is the embrace of contradiction. It wasn't necessarily comfortable for her, but it was life-altering. Todd, even more so, was rocked to the core. He had to tell her story. He went back to Kansas and immediately began trying to figure out how he could organize story exchanges between Christians and Muslims in his town. Most stunning of all is that he changed the rule of his online gun website in order not to allow people to go anonymously on his website. He changed the rules. The two became Facebook friends and remain so to this day, the past couple of months, in contact with one another, looking for ways that they can breach the gap that this country is seeing all the time. How do they do it? They did it by storytelling. They did it by the nuance of language. They did it by trying to understand one another. You think that you come in here tonight to be entertained or whatever else it happens to be. No, you're actually changing the world. We have to do this over and over again. You should be going out to more and more schools in Portland. You should be going out to all the schools in rural Oregon and allowing people access to stories and storytelling and telling them that it's dignified, that it's wonderful, that's incredible that they have a story to tell. But guess what? Listen to the other person too. All of this comes from looking someone else in the eye. All of this from the simple art of listening and telling. Our stories, our language, our change can't go on, must go on. Thank you.
That was Colin McCann speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in March 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks. Join A to Z and help make this podcast and all our programming possible. Give today at literary-arts.org/donate. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.